It's wonderful to be here, and thank you for the privilege of addressing you. I am not an infectious disease guy, obviously, and I did not stay in a Holiday Inn Express last night. I will tell you that my talk is actually very much in sequence with these last two talks. It's really about the need for public education, disease prevention, health promotion, appreciating the science and where the science leads us, as well as appreciating where, unfortunately, the economics lead us. I should give my disclosures working for the American Cancer Society, a charity in Emory University, and CNN keeps me around, and occasionally they put Sanjay Gupta and I on TV together because the contrast makes him look even prettier. And then I do some consulting for the government. I also published a book which is somewhat related to the subject of this talk, but I'm not here to promote the book, which is now about 4 years old. Over the last 35, 40 years, we have gone from talking about minority health and special populations and health disparities and health. Now we're talking about health equality and now health equity. And I'm going to use these things on observations to tell you why we need to transform our healthcare system so that we can provide better care for a large number of people. And we're going to talk a lot about value in healthcare as we talk about health disparities. Now, value in healthcare is a talk about economics, medical ethics, and health outcomes. And value is outcomes achieved divided by cost. That is simply the more something costs, the lower the value of what you get. Indeed, Warren Buffett says price is what you pay and value is what you get. Again, value equals outcomes achieved divided by cost. Now, there's been tremendous efforts in the United States over the last few years at cost containment, which have been widely unacceptable. Cost containment, of course, is the business practice of maintaining expense levels to prevent unnecessary spending or thoughtfully reducing expenses without diminishing quality. Now, one person's cost containment is another person's reduction in income. I am reminded by these quotes, Upton Sinclair, and by the way, I frequently talk to urologists about why we shouldn't be doing prostate cancer screening. I talk to radiologists about why we shouldn't be doing as much mammography screening, and I'm always talking to them and thinking about Upton Sinclair's comment that it's difficult to get a man or a woman to understand something when his or her salary depends on his or her not understanding it. And again, and this audience, I think, knows Dr. Hal Sachs, who's one of the giants in internal medicine, who once said a professional is someone who puts his interests above his patients, who puts the interest of his patients above his own. And I think that's where we really need to go in terms of pushing science and using science to figure out what we are doing in medicine. One of the most important things in the economics of medicine that's frequently not appreciated. We talk about it, but we don't appreciate it, and that is how much medicine costs in the United States. In 2011, medicine cost $2.7 trillion. Now, $2.7 trillion is a lot of money. Indeed, if we talk about a million seconds ago, it was sometime Tuesday of last week. If we talk about a billion seconds ago, it was sometime around the time that Jimmy Carter became president, which was 1976. If we talk about a trillion seconds ago, we're talking about 30,000 years before Christ. So a trillion is a big number. To give you an idea of how much a trillion is, we spent $1.1 trillion on food in the United States in 2011. All of personal consumption in China was $1.4 trillion, and we spent $2.7 trillion on health care. Health care is 17.7 to 17.9% of our gross domestic product. Translated, for every dollar spent in the United States, about 18 cents is spent on health care. Putting that into another perspective, if the American economy, if the American healthcare economy were a country, it would be the fifth largest economy in the world. We spend more on healthcare in the United States than was spent on everything in France in 2011, France being the fifth largest economy in the world. Now, the trends on this are getting really bad, by the way. For every American man, woman, and child, we spent $8,508 on health care in 2011. It was actually more last year, but we don't have a complete data set beyond 2011 at this point. These are a number of other countries that show the per-person spending. By the way, the trends in the United States are especially bad. If the last 30 years predict the next 30 years, sometime around 2030 to 2035 is when the average cost of a family health care policy, insurance policy, will be equivalent to the median income in the United States. That translates into we will get health care reform, because that's not possible. Right. Healthcare will reform. The question is, are we going to do it in a controlled fashion, or are we going to let things happen as they may be? Please note here that $8,500 per person is the largest. $5,600 per person in Switzerland is the second largest. And the numbers in parentheses are percent of economy. Our 17.7 to 17.9% of our economy is by far the largest. You'll note that the Netherlands is number two at 11.9%, slightly less than 12% of everything spent in the Netherlands is spent on healthcare. I want to point out that healthcare is an overwhelming proportion of the U.S. economy versus all of these other economies, because their health outcomes, by and large, are actually better than ours in the United States. I should note that in the United States, the costs of a number of things, I have just here bypass surgery and knee replacement, are far greater than they are in a number of countries that we like to compare ourselves to. I should note that the average cost of a prescription for a year in the United States is nearly $950. Far more than in any other country. And there are a couple of reasons. My favorite, of course, is the fact that we, for 12 years, one of the five most prescribed drugs in the United States was Nexium at $180 a month. It was Nexium, by the way, was marketed because it had the active ingredient in Prilosec in it. And Prilosec was available as a generic during those 12 years for $8 a month. Yet Nexium was one of the five most prescribed drugs in the U.S. And that's, by the way, a uniquely American thing, because when AstraZeneca, sorry if anybody from AstraZeneca is in the audience, when AstraZeneca went to Canada and the European Union to get a patent on Nexium, Canada and the European Union said, we gave you that patent when you gave you the patent for Prilosec. So that was a uniquely American scam. Now, healthcare consumption by country and outcomes. I want to note that we in the United States, this is asthma mortality from age 5 to 39 per 100,000, and you can see the United States at the bottom doesn't do very well compared to most other countries. And then, of course, lower extremity amputations do the diabetes. We, again, don't do as well. When we look at my own world of cancer mortality, we don't do as well. This is life expectancy, and as you can see here, yes, I think you can see the cursor. This is cost per person in the United States here in red, and all the other dots are cost per person in all of these other countries, and you can see, pardon me, you can see average life expectancy. The average life expectancy in European countries in the United States and Canada is actually there at about 80, but you can see we are to the left of 80. So we don't get what we pay for. We pay more, and we don't do nearly as well. So our healthcare system is really hurting. And by the way, some people say we shouldn't use overall life expectancy because it includes our very low, infant mortality, and our infant mortality is actually higher than some other countries because we try to save some babies that other countries don't try to save. This is life expectancy for people who have reached the age of 65. And you see, we are 12th for males and 16th for females. So we still don't do very well for life expectancy. Now let's look at some disparities within the U.S., and this is again from an oncologic perspective. This is a slide that we published, started publishing in the 1990s and become somewhat famous for. And this is death rate per 100,000 age adjusted for colon cancer for black men in blue, white men in red, black women in green, white women in purple, and just showing as you go from left to right, the disparities have increased virtually every year since the early 1980s. And then the disparities in death rate for black and white are greater today than they were at any time in our history. And much of our discussion about health disparities and health equity has in the past focused on black-white differences. Then we got a little more sophisticated and we started realizing that everybody in the United States is not black and white. We started looking at other races and ethnicities. Now we're starting to look at people by what state they live in. We've gone from black-white differences to Massachusetts-Mississippi differences. This is death rates over the last 25 years in Massachusetts and New York. It's been a 40% decline in age-adjusted death rate in colorectal cancer in Massachusetts and New York. You can see here in Mississippi over the last 25 years there's been almost no decline, and in Alabama the decline has been slightly less than 10%. We can actually do something very, very similar in breast cancer. We've had a 35% decline in breast cancer death rates over the last 25 years, but not in those states that are orange. Those states that are orange have had less than a 10% decline, while the United States as a whole has had a 35% decline. As a matter of fact, if you let me remove those states from the United States, I can get the breast cancer death rate reduction well over 40%. You see, we're not practicing medicine in a homogeneous fashion. We're paying more for medical care than anybody else in the world when we're not getting out of it what we should be getting, and then we're not practicing it equally. I would contend that the biology and genetics of someone who lives in Massachusetts is not different from the biology and genetics of someone who lives in Alabama or Mississippi. It's the problem is we're not getting healthcare. And when I say healthcare, I mean global. I'm talking about preventative services. I'm talking about education. I'm talking about the fact that the obesity rate for children in Mississippi is far worse than it is for kids in Connecticut and Massachusetts, or for kids in North Carolina, for that matter. I'm talking about prevention, diagnostics, and treatment, not just for cancer, but for a number of diseases. You see, in the United States, one of the problems is some people consume too much health care, meaning unnecessary care is given. Some consume too little, meaning necessary care is not given. And we could actually decrease the waste and improve overall health and do it more cheaply if we just started following evidence-based medicine. Now, in my own field of oncology, we do screening tests of no proven value. We do treatments of no proven value. We do laboratory and radiologic imaging for convenience. We do it because we can't find the original. That's going away now that we have digital X-ray and digital CT. We do it for real or imagined legal defense. Sometimes we do testing because of tradition. I'm going to sum up by just saying our healthcare system is heavily focused on addressing illness, and we need to transform to one that values both evidence-based medicine as well as prevention of disease. The talks that we heard earlier about public education are incredibly important. The talk that we heard about vaccines, and unfortunately our lack of acceptance of the human papilloma vaccine, is case in point to how we don't push prevention. The fact that we now have gone from 15% of American adults being obese in 1970 to nearly 40% in 2016. I'm talking about obesity. I don't talk about the condition known as being overweight because of my own conflict of interest. The fact that smoking rates are still at 20%. The problem is the system is not failing. Our medical system is failure. Failure is the system. And we've actually accepted a subtle form of corruption where we don't follow the science, and the science is clearly telling us we need to be orthodox in our interpretation of clinical trials findings. The science is clearly telling us we need to value prevention of disease. And so I thank you for welcoming me, a cancer doc, into a group of sexually transmitted infection specialists, and it's been wonderful to be here.
Fantastic. Thanks to you all for a really terrific spectrum of discussion and opinions, a really, really eclectic session. We have 5 minutes or so for questions, so people who have questions, please come to the mic, and we'll start with you over there. And if I could remind people to please introduce yourself and tell us where you're from.
Okay. I'm Jolynn Clemens, and I'm a risk manager and an ambassador for the insurance industry. And I have a question and comment to the panel in regards to prevention. As a risk manager, I created an app that allows people to refer their potential partner to get a safe dating credential, and this is in partnership with Quest Diagnostics and providers, their provider. It's HIPAA compliant, and they can get tested. It includes Zika, and it's all the personal information and results stay with the provider and with Quest. And I would like to invite providers to utilize the app. It's XOXY.
I'm going to actually have to ask you to just ask your question, please.
Okay. And my question is, what role do you believe technology plays in the prevention of the spread of STIs?
Any of the panelists want to take a stab at that? Dr. Hook.
That's a global question. Technology provides us with new tools for STI diagnosis. It certainly provides new tools for partner management. So it's an important part of the armamentarium, and it accompanies the rest of our efforts to control STIs.
Thanks. Thank you, Dr. Hook.
Thank you.
Gail, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say that the challenges are, though, we want to increase access. But as we've heard, we don't want to have unnecessary screening. And the challenge with technology, it can widely increase access, but we could be spending a lot of money of testing people who are at really low risk for STIs. And we know our tests are not perfect. You can end up with false positives that certainly have serious relationship consequences and other issues, and certainly could continue to increase the cost of our healthcare that we provide. So that's the balance that we've got to figure out. How do we increase access but target it to the populations in need?
And we certainly can't let it go without acknowledging the explosive synergy that certain technology apps have had on fueling some STI epidemics. Over there, thanks.
Thank you all for great presentations. Susie Baldwin, Los Angeles County Public Health. My question is for Dr. Brawley around your last slide saying that we've accepted a subtle form of corruption. And I'm wondering if you might consider that perhaps when you look at the data of the United States versus the other OECD countries, what we're spending on healthcare, prescriptions, the amount of overhead that goes to insurance companies, and the way our political process works when it comes to healthcare payments, how maybe it's not such a subtle form of corruption after all, and what we can do to change that.
Okay.
You're definitely on my side. In the long-form version of my talk, I talk about who's to blame, and it's the doctors, it's the lawyers, it's the hospitals. I also point out that healthcare insurances in 2014 had 20% profits, and only oil companies were more profitable than health insurance companies in 2014. The Affordable Care Act, which is the elephant in the room, is insurance payment reform, and actually removes insurance companies from taking risk and actually throws the risk actually on clinical providers. And so there is a lot of issues there. And I take your point that the, I go into these very staid meetings sometimes, and I have to be a little bit subtle.
Thank you very much for that provocative question, and thanks to everyone for your attention. We're right at 10:30, so I'm actually going to wrap up and keep us on time. Thanks again. Thanks to our speakers.